Good evening and welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kerry Curtis, co-chair of the club's Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum and your chair for today. We welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit to join us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my distinct pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Robert Gottlieb. Bob is a professor at Occidental College in Los Angeles. He's the author or co-author of a number of books, most recently Food Justice, which has just been published, and that's what he's going to talk about tonight, and also another book, Reinventing Los Angeles, Nature and Community in the Global City, an interesting book, and 10 other books. He's written for numerous publications, newspapers, magazines, academic journals, and so forth, and he is the editor of two MIT Press series, Urban and Industrial Environments, and Food, Health, and Environment. A longtime activist and historian of social movements, Professor Gottlieb has been directly engaged in policy, program development, and community action projects in such areas as food systems, transportation and land use, the urban environment, resource policy, and work and industry. Please join me in welcoming Robert Gottlieb.
Well, I do wander around quite a bit, actually. That's my style. I'm a wanderer. And that keeps it a little bit more informal. And I'm really interested in your feedback as well from the things I'll be presenting for you. Kerry mentioned the work we do at Occidental. It's actually an institute. It's called the Urban and Environmental Policy Institute. And I thought I'd actually describe just a bit about it because it really sets up the discussion, I think, about food justice and what we also try to do in the book. My co-author is Anupama Joshi, who is part of UEPI, but she co-directs an organization called the National Farm to School Network. And I'll describe a little bit about the significance of that in terms of food justice. UEPI is an interesting hybrid. It's an organization that includes people who are engaged in research and education. Our mission statement that we're reworking as I talk characterizes what we do as mobilizing, incubating, connecting, and educating. It's which spells mice, little mice running around making changes. We talk about a justice and green and livability agenda, and we have very distinct ways of thinking about those three concepts that are addressing issues like power and inequality, the urban environment, how people live, work, play, and eat, see the role that we have from that academic side as helping create a new generation of social change agents, if you will. But we also do a lot of other things that really put us in the community side rather than the academic side. We have organizers. We, for example, played an important role with a number of other key food justice-type organizations in L.A. to get initially the sodas out of the vending machines in Los Angeles Unified School District. And that came about in part because we had a Latina parent whose kids were in the school district who joined us as an organizer in the organization. We do a lot of work on policy, bringing about thinking about the kind of innovative policies that would really support changes on the ground. So we operate, as Kerry mentioned, in a number of different issue areas. Transportation, of course, is one, and housing. We do a lot around immigration. We have a whole program in conjunction with a number of other groups around global trade and goods movement, freight traffic, a really powerful environmental and health issue affecting communities around the country, and particularly in Southern California. And we do a lot around food. That's really our strongest part of what UEPI does in this kind of hybrid organization that's both community action and research and academic, sort of the action research notion. So the food projects and food work that we do, I think, gives can give you a sense of how we approach the notion of food justice and what we did in the book. Farm to school is a good example. We started the first farm to school program in the mid-1990s. There were only three at that point. One was in Santa Monica, which was kind of the flagship program. There were two, in one in Florida and one in North Carolina, that were basically organized to help support African-American farmers in those areas. But our concept when we started that program was, on the one hand, you had the vulnerable population of local, small, regional farmers who were under stress and had been under stress for a number of years, and wanting to figure out ways in which you could support that constituency above and beyond the strategies of direct marketing, such as farmers markets or CSAs. And the other hand, you had K-12 population, which was food insecure in the deepest sense, that both in the communities that so much of the K-12 school population were not having access to healthy, fresh, affordable food. We were discovering at the same time that the Farm to School program was being initiated, and some of the early research that was developing, that you had a constituency, particularly in schools that were predominantly serving free and reduced lunch, kids that were whose families were close to the poverty line, who were going hungry a number of days of the month, who also were starting to see at that point the combination of hunger and obesity in the same population. And so much of that had to do with the food that was available. And so the notion of farm to school was, how do you change that food environment? And a starting point would be the school food environment. And how do you get a different kind of source of food and in the school cafeteria? So that was farm to school. We now have a program, a pilot program, called Farm to Preschool, where we're doing a series of pilot programs in preschools around Southern California. One is actually in San Diego as well. Amongst other things, the preschool population, the 0 to 5 population, is experiencing some of the most rapid increases in obesity and getting into the kind of patterns around diet and eating that are going to contribute to the potential for a lifelong experience of unhealthy eating, if you will, creating another generation of young people, and then people subsequently who will be health challenged because of that. So we have farm to preschool programs, thinking of different ways in which you get kids who are 3, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old to experience food, whether it's through garden programs, whether it's through thinking about seasonal food, getting it into the snack and lunch programs. So we have that as a new initiative. We have a program called Farm to WIC, which involves thinking about women and children, how you can begin to, whether it's through the WIC benefits that allow that constituency to shop in farmers markets, but also what about the food in what are called the WIC-only stores? Can you get fresh produce coming directly from farms, regional farms, local farms, into those WIC-only stores. So we're partnering with some of those stores to see, because there are now opportunities through new programs that are available to WIC clients to access fresh produce. And so we're working with the stores to explore how you can do that. We're working with affordable housing developers. We have a program with a couple of different housing developers to think about that constituency, often a very food insecure constituency, how you can both grow food on the housing developments, whether it's even a container garden, if you will, as well as residents in communities becoming food champions, working with other community groups that can talk about the food environment in that community and how to change it. We're working with one of the community groups on the link between food and transportation, access issues, really critical questions that have to do with not only what's in the food environment, but how does one access it and where does one access food, and thinking about transportation strategies in relation to that. Innovative programs that are starting to develop around the country that make that connection. We have a program that we call the Grocery Accountability Project, otherwise known as the GAP, where you have both the problem of supermarkets that have abandoned urban core communities and those markets that come back into the urban core communities sometimes leave something to be desired, whether it's from a perspective of the kind of food that is heavily promoted, what's available, and then a range of other issues that are both in terms of the people who work in those stores as well as some of the other practices. And so you want to both encourage stores to come into communities, but you want to have some measure of accountability that has to do with, if you will, from a food justice and a social justice perspective. And I could go, there are two or three other programs, but that, I think, gives you a kind of a snapshot of how we approach the issues of food, both as a systems issue and then, in particular, communities, how those food system issues are experienced. So let me tell you a little about the book and how we organized it and the role we see it playing now in talks we're starting to give around the country. To quote my 94-year-old mother-in-law, so what is food justice? And it's an interesting question because within the food movement, it's a term that's starting to be applied, but it has lots of different ways in which it's being used. So we have a very particular way to use the term that's also, I think, tied into the analysis that we have about how the food system functions, but it's also it's tied to where and how we see the food movement developing. So our definition is, on the one hand, we do have a food system that is creates enormous impacts and is structured in such a way that it is deeply unjust. It contributes to food insecurity. It is transforming the nature of the food production system. It's global in the way it operates in terms of the supply chains that exist within the food system, from where the food is produced in multiple places and processed and ends up in the places where it's sold and consumed. So this notion of food justice is a systems approach. It's a systems issue that you can't really talk about any particular entry point to the food system, whether it's issues about supermarkets or issues about how food is grown or issues about the people who work within the food system without seeing it in a systems context, that you need to see changes that take place across the board in the food system. So that's one definition. And that resonates with so many of the advocates within the food movement who increasingly think about this is a global food system, how do we change it, and how do we talk about it as well as act upon it. However, we say food justice is more than just a systems issue. Food justice is also about disparities. It's about who, in fact, within this food system is experiencing the most hazards, the most problems of inequality, having the least connection to food because of the nature of the food that they encounter in their communities, and as well as the people who are the food producers. So you have to think about system impacts and then where are the inequalities, where are the disparities. So we have, for example, an obesity crisis, and it's across all population groups. It's all age groups, all constituencies. There's obesity problems in Beverly Hills, but the deepest problems around this change in obesity that connects to some of the health outcomes from obesity are deepest in low-income communities and communities of color. And it's not difficult to make the jump to say, well, it's very much tied to what is the food experience, what kind of food is available, what's the structure of food in through the way the system operates that's experienced by low-income communities, whether it's lack of supermarkets, whether it's farmers markets, for example, which back in the late 70s really began as an approach to bringing healthy, affordable food in low-income communities. The first farmers market in L.A., the first two farmers markets in L.A., were sponsored by a group called the Interfaith Hunger Coalition in Gardena and South L.A. that were designed really as a kind of a low-income strategy to bring healthy food because, in fact, the supermarkets had abandoned those communities. So the strategy, which was modestly successful, changed over time, in part because farmers markets, for very understandable reasons, and in fact one could say very positive reasons, became very attractive both to the farmers and to the people who shopped at the farmers markets in middle-class communities. Farmers markets are great. They're community meeting places. There are ways to connect with food differently. Farmers saw the opportunity because they could increase the volume of sales, they could get a better price point, a whole range of reasons that allowed middle-class farmers markets to flourish and the farmers markets in low-income communities to be more challenged in terms of their success. Now, that's starting to change. I'll get into that a little bit when we talk about how to bring about the change. So now we have a strategy for change that was really designed to address the inequities, the vulnerabilities in the system that in turn have now kind of reinforced some of those same problems, even though it's sort of an unintended consequence because the idea is not to knock the farmers market and the middle class communities, but to think about ways in which you develop farmers markets in low-income communities. But the other side of that is what kind of food is available in those communities, and that's where you have the issue of corner stores, liquor stores that sell that one or two rotting pieces of fruit and vegetables that are there, and the fast food explosion that took place beginning really only in the 1960s and early 1970s that are significantly concentrated, not exclusively concentrated, but significantly concentrated in low-income communities. There's a term that some researchers are now starting to use. Instead of thinking about low-income communities as food deserts, i.e. the absence of, say, that full-service supermarket, calling them food swamps, that these are places that have significant issues in relation to what food is available as well as what food is not available. So second part of our definition, got to deal with it as a systems issue. You have to think of it in the context of disparities. You can't have a food movement that does not address this issue of disparities, but you can have a food justice movement that isn't thinking in system terms. And the third definition we've used in our book is that one of the beauties of the food movement today is the understanding that food is an issue that not only cuts across class lines, that not only brings up system issues, but connects to so many other issues. And so a food movement necessarily needs to be an environmental movement. A food movement necessarily has to be dealing with community economic development issues. A food movement necessarily has to be thinking about land use issues. A food movement has to also be thinking about these questions of inequality and power, a social justice movement, if you will. And a food movement has to be a labor movement. It has to deal with the issues that amongst the most profound disparities have to do with the people who work in the fields, the people who work in the kind of industrialization of meat production that's taken place in the last 30, 40 years, transformation of the workforce in those industries that made it a most vulnerable constituency, the people who work in the restaurants, in the fast food restaurants, and the full service restaurants, and now even increasingly the people who work in the food stores and the retail side. You've had a kind of a process of industrialization taking place in food retail, best embodied by the entree of Walmart into the food business. Walmart in the 1987 had 0% of the food share, the share of the food market in the U.S. and had no presence in terms of its global operations. Today, it's in the U.S., it's 37%, double the size of its nearest competitor. And it is the largest global food retailer operating in something like 20 countries around the world. It's the largest in Mexico, for example. Walmex, as it's called, is the largest food retailer. Within that, you've got a change in also what's going on in terms of the people who work in food retail. So worker justice, going back to the point I'm making about how to think of yourselves as a food justice movement that necessarily connects with these other range of issues that are out there that food directly intersects, and you need to speak to the ways in which they intersect. So that's our definition. Systems issue, disparities, the connection to a larger kind of social justice framework in terms of housing, land use, transportation, worker justice related issues. And that's what we do in the first half of the book. We kind of do a walk through the food system, looking at those three sets of ways to interpret food justice. How is it a systems issue? What's going on in terms of the producing food? What's going on in terms of the processing and manufacturing of food? How is this a global system. One of the stories we tell is how, in starting off the chapter on the globalization of food, how we've seen a change in how garlic is sourced and produced, particularly in terms of the processing of garlic. It's a product from China. Very recent. Really, we're talking about 15, 17 years. You've had an enormous change. And then we compare that to what's gone on in China in terms of the rise of a of snack food, junk food, and fast food in China. In particular, we trace how Pepsi, through its Frito-Lay subdivision, entered into wanting to develop its product in China. And the way the Chinese operated in terms of thinking about how an American company could, or a global company could come in, they said, well, you have to generate your product here. So PepsiCo took over a number of potato farms. It's the largest potato grower in China, making green tea potato chips and other products that have also contributed to, aside from everything else, a growing obesity problem in China, which had a zero problem only 15, 20 years ago. So it's a global food system, and we do a walk through the food system, and I'm giving you little snapshots of that. But the second half of the book, and I'll spend just a few minutes on that to give you some time for interaction, is a narrative of kind of the places where change has begun to happen. Where, in fact, is the food justice movement? Where does it operate? How does it connect with the different places within the food system where changes are beginning to happen? And one of the wonderful things about doing this book is telling those stories, and then actually going around the country now. Anupam and I have been going around the country, having events with some of the folks that we talk about in the book. So last week, I had an event in Sacramento and did a dialogue with one of the co-owners of a farm, Full Belly Farm. Some of you might know it. Judith Redman, old, long champion around food justice issues. And I actually got the opportunity to stay at the farm before we had our event. And we profiled Full Belly Farm as an illustration of a way some of the new farms are developing, and particularly from a food justice perspective of how Full Belly operates, whether it's from an environmental perspective, what they do in terms of what they grow and how they grow, in terms of their workforce and the relationships that they've established in terms of a long-term connection with the people who work on the farm. The very first event we had was in New Orleans, where we went to a community center in New Orleans to share the program with a group called the Rethinkers, a bunch of middle school kids who, in the period after Katrina, started to mobilize around wanting to change what was going on with their schools. The schools had been decimated. They didn't want to go back to the status quo ante. They wanted to change the schools, and they had different entry points. The first year, 06, second year, 07, they worked with people in the community to provide them the kind of skills and operation and knowledge that allow them to become advocates and social justice champions, or educational justice champions, if you will. The third year that they organized themselves, they focused on food. And they looked at the fact that they couldn't stand the food that was in the cafeteria. They thought that the food environment at the school was abysmal in terms of they didn't have enough time to eat. The cafeteria was run down. The utensils became the symbol, the spork, the plastic fork and spoon one side, and the plastic spork spoon on the other side. So they mobilized around it, and they said, well, they learned about farm to school, and they decided that having a school garden on the grounds was important, and changing the school food environment was significant and critical. And they thought about, well, what kind of food is available here in New Orleans? And they said, shrimp. And where's the shrimp come from? It doesn't come from New Orleans. It comes from industrial farm shrimp that was undercutting, in fact, the shrimpers in New Orleans. So they hooked up with the shrimpers and they said, we want New Orleans shrimp in the cafeteria when you serve shrimp, and assume that somehow we think this is New Orleans food when it's not. So anyway, these are middle school kids, and I first encountered them at a conference in Portland in 2009, and they got up and told their story, and it blew us away. So we went to New Orleans, and we had them sit at the table with us and said, you know, you helped write this book, and we wrote this book, but you're a food justice champion. And the people who came, of course, understood that because of there is, in fact, a very vibrant, active food justice movement in New Orleans, of which the Rethinkers are one important piece. In Washington, D.C., I'm going to be going there in April. We're going to hook up with another food justice champion, Norma Flores, who has become kind of a symbol of the issue of the immigrants who come and work in the fields, particularly the children who work in the fields and are subject to the kind of abuses that farm workers experience and what happens in their lives. And we told Norma's story and how, in fact, she made this breakthrough in her life at a point where she was thinking, you know, how do I, in fact, move forward in terms of the unsettled nature of the immigrant farm worker experience? And she had an epiphany that what she needed to do is become an advocate around the children in the fields. And that's what she's doing now. She's hooked up with one of the key organizations that's advocating around immigrant rights, and she runs a program called Children in the Fields. Another example of a kind of the food justice story that we tell in the book. On Monday, I'm going to be speaking at a press conference of an organization that's being formed in L.A. that originated first in New York when the World Trade Center went down. They had a restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center, and it was destroyed. And when it was rebuilt, the people who worked in the restaurant, who actually were a union workforce that were getting at least a living wage, were all laid off, or not rehired, I should say. And the new workforce that came in was non-union and not paid a living wage, which is really the condition of so many of the workers in the restaurant industry. So this group of restaurant workers created their own cooperative restaurant, but more importantly, or even more importantly, they became champions, food justice champions, organizing around the plight of restaurant workers in a situation where we've seen this proliferation of restaurants that have developed as more and more people eat out rather than eating in, and the people who work in that sector of the food system are amongst the most vulnerable. So this organization, Restaurant Opportunity Center, is starting a chapter in L.A. They've just done a study, and we talked about the work in New York, but now I have the benefit of being able to talk about food justice in the context of their mobilization in L.A. So there are a number of these stories we tell. Should I tell one more? I'll tell one more and then open it up to you. And that's a more personal story, which is really goes to the origins of Farm to School. And this would go back to that 1996-97 period when we were thinking about how do we support particularly low-income farmers markets with individuals who maybe could purchase food separate from the market, kind of a CSA model, but do it in a context that would allow kind of low-income residents to participate. It's a complicated story, but it wasn't working for a number of reasons. And kind of lights went off for me that maybe the connection should be not as residents, but how they are in the institutions in that community, i.e. schools. You know, why not connect the program that we had created of how to support the local farmers market by making a connection to the schools? And I, my daughter was then in Santa Monica at an elementary school that actually had a pretty substantial free and reduced population. Even Santa Monica has a free and reduced. It was about 50% in that school. And so our center folks, myself included, went to the food service director and said, Santa Monica's got a fair number of farmers markets. Why not set up a program where you have a salad bar that sources from the farmers markets? And the food service director, a fellow by the name of Rodney Taylor, been in the food service business a long time, he's African American, and he said, as he likes to talk about it later, he said, oh, here is one of those white parents with too much time on his hand bugging me to do something that's just crackpot idea. So he's a parent in the school district, why not try out this idea, but we'll show that it's destined to fail. So we set up a salad bar with farmers market produce, and Rodney said, we have a hot meal, and then we'll have the salad bar. Let's do pizza and see who goes to the salad bar and who goes to the pizza. What he didn't know is that this wasn't just a parent who with too much time on his hands, but part of a center that was thinking about how do you organize to reach the parents, to reach the kids in the schools, and think about how they can connect with food differently. So we organized. We had taste tests, and the kids did have a school garden they were part of. And they said, hey, that looks like food that's part of the school garden. You know, hey, we like that food. And we talked to the largely Latino parent population and said, how would you organize this? A salad bar that would appeal to the kids. Well, make sure you've got a slice of lime for the lettuce. What is it that you think the kids would feel is most appealing? And so we talked about what other things to source that would be part of the salad. It was an organizing strategy. And the day occurred that the salad bar went in and the pizza was there, and 75% of the kids went to the salad bar. They also, of course, had the opportunity to choose the food they wanted, which you never got in a school food setting. And we convinced the food service director as a pilot, let's give them a little more time to go through the lines to get the food. All situations that are really critical to make that happen. So Rodney, when he saw that, it was like a moment in time where he saw his life change, as he likes to put it, before his eyes, that there was new meaning in his life if he could create a situation where kids not only were eating well, but that the mission of school food service was a mission of health and nutrition, and that he could connect with farmers that he got to know, first at the farmers market. He's now at the Riverside Unified School District working with the farmers out in the Inland Valley. And he's a food justice champion. He goes around the country now talking to other food service directors. He talks their language. He connects with the issues and the problems. It's not a Jamie Oliver situation. It's a situation where he can actually be part of a constituency that says, we can do it differently. There are challenges. There are enormous challenges how we can do it. But I'll tell you how I did it, first in Santa Monica and then in Riverside. So that's a food justice champion story. It's enormously gratifying for myself. My daughter still eats salads. It embodied for us another one of the ways which we tell the story of changes that happen on the ground that begin to create a kind of a narrative, a mosaic of food justice that's happening around the country. So I'll stop with that and give you an opportunity to dialogue and say your thoughts.
You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kerry Curtis, chair of the club's Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our speaker is Robert Gottlieb, author of the new book, Food Justice. And now we have time for some audience questions. So maybe, Bob, could you use that mic for a while?
Okay. I won't roam anymore.
And
Yes, you mentioned the figure 37% of Walmart. I couldn't quite understand that. Does that mean that Walmart sells 37% of all the groceries in the United States?
Yes. They have a 37% share of the food retail market now in the U.S. I don't know the numbers globally, but they are the largest global food retailer. And they do have the largest share in Mexico, because we talked a little bit about what they're doing in Mexico.
Even bigger than Safeway.
More than double. More than double, yeah.
It seems that the biggest reason for obesity epidemic is the wrong foods are subsidized. Grains are subsidized and given to livestock and so on. And if you have a dollar, you buy a hamburger, you don't buy an apple. That's something you can't really change, but how do you deal with that? How do you work around this?
Well, it's a really great question. Well, one of the things is, you know, the long, hard slog through the Farm Bill, which often, and other legislation, but particularly the Farm Bill. And, you know, the different parts of the food movement have gone through a kind of a learning experience about addressing the Farm Bill and what can be accomplished and what can't be accomplished at this stage of the game. But it's coming up again in 2012. So that's one point of intervention that can take place. The other way to start addressing that is to think about ways in which you shift the equation. That could be as simple as, it's not a very simple process, but it's a simple idea of taxing or creating fees, to use the current language, on the food that you don't want people to eat, with that creates mechanisms to subsidize better the food that you do want them to eat. So there's been a little bit of subsidizing the food, you know, like the WIC benefit programs, and the farm to school is now given a pot of money through the child nutrition legislation. There's a new AmeriCorps program that our institute was helped incubate called Food Corps that's just rolling out as we talk. So we're going to now have an AmeriCorps program where young people can work for a year helping set up school gardens and farm-to-school programs. So it operates at both those levels. Does that mean that you've won the game? Absolutely not. The point is really important and well taken in terms of what takes place within the kind of pricing structure of commodities and what that represents when you get the food, whether in the restaurant or in the store. But, you know, we have a phrase that in the book that I took from one of my from my earlier days, my hero, a man by the name of Rudy Dutschke, who was part of a organization in Germany called German SDS, and he had a phrase that I've always loved because I think it really captures what it means to think about change. And the phrase is that we have to really do a long march through the institutions, that we have to operate thinking about how change happens. And so farm to school is not the answer, but it's an entry point. It shows here's this kind of institution of school food and what you begin to do to bring about that change. Well, what are the other entry points? Well, of course, food markets and food retail industry is another entry point. How do you begin to change that, whether you're creating alternative models and or you're trying to, as I mentioned earlier, create a kind of a system and a mechanism of accountability? Is it food growing? Well, again, you have new farmers, you have immigrant farmers, you have urban agriculture, you have different entry points thinking about growing food differently, but you've got to look at the industrial agricultural system, starting with the people who work in the fields, but going through in terms of how those farms operate and what policies are established to reinforce that. And the players who come in and help determine the nature of the agricultural production system, everyone from the Cargills to the Monsantos that are increasingly influencing what happens in terms of growing food. So you've got to mobilize, you've got to organize, you've got to advocate around those issues as well as thinking about the alternatives. So it's a long march to the institutions. You have to think about ways in which change can occur, but keep your eye on the prize, which is system change, and keep your eye on the bigger prize, which is a social justice vision about how food intersects with other institutions and other ways in which we're organized in our society.
I read your book, and it was excellent. I really recommend it. My question is about the fact that in California we expect there to be cuts in education. We know that a vegetarian diet is cheaper than a meat-based diet. We know that most of the kids in our public schools are of races that are lactose intolerant and that all kids don't need milk. So are there efforts to try to say part of the way to reduce cost and improve the quality is to eliminate meat and dairy from our schools in California?
Okay. Limited yes to the answer. When we were organizing in LAUSD, first around the competitive foods, the sodas and the junk food and the vending machines, one of the other organizing strategies was to try and get policy in that cut across what gets served in the cafeteria and how it's organized. And milk was one of those issues. And pushing for substitutes for milk, but to meet the USDA requirements for it, like soy milk would be an illustration of that. And did we get the change? A little bit. Was it wholesale change? No. Is it extended through other parts of school food operations around the country? Not a lot. But that's part of the argument of the National Farm to School Network, is to think about across the board what's available, what's prepared, and not just think about the fruits and vegetables as the only entry point for bringing about the change in the school food environment. So does it mean that meat and changing the dairy equivalent will answer the cost of food? Not exactly, because it has a lot to do with the previous question in terms of how, in fact, those products are priced and they enter into the school food system. Well, then you need to also talk about those issues and think about how you compare prices as well as identify what needs to happen in terms of the change. I don't think you'll convince school food service right now that that's the cheaper diet, but you can begin to change that in terms of the health of the products and the alternatives that could be developed for them. And then you can begin to see, well, can you construct a system where your pricing is at least equivalent, if not ultimately cheaper? And right now, it's a harder argument to make.
Thanks for your comments. A couple of weeks ago, the New York Times had an article about a community in Los Angeles that had come together to basically boycott any additional fast food restaurants in their community. And I just wondered what your comments or thoughts were about that strategy.
Well, it's actually, there is a formal moratorium on new fast food construction in a particular zone in South L.A. It did come about through a number of community groups mobilizing around the issue. The city council member in that district, who's now going to run for mayor, thought that this would be a good opportunity for her to kind of profile herself. She had actually been on the wrong side of a fight around what was known as the South Central Farm or the South Central Garden. So she picked up on the fast food issue and has become its champion, and she's very effective. And now it's been extended. It was a pilot program. There's been some evaluation. Rand did a study. Not blazing results, but partly it's too early to tell. You already have a saturation of fast food in that community. This was really a moratorium on new fast food restaurants. But it's a strategy that people are paying attention to around the country. I think an even better strategy is this notion of the fees on fast food and on certain products. And that's the one that the industry is really mobilizing against. You had an interview with the CEO of Pepsi, who's becoming a big champion of, well, we're going to reduce our sugar percentage in our sodas. And when New York, when Bloomberg started talking about wanting to impose a fee on sugar, she said, we're going to, in fact, take out all our operations. You're going to lose so many jobs if you dare to try and challenge us on that issue. So that clearly cut close to home. You know, when we banned the sodas and the vending machines, they used that same argument. And then they discovered, well, you know, we can use our bottled water as our substitute in the vending machines. And then we got to push on getting the vending machines out. I just chatted today with Peter Glick from the Pacific Institute, who did this book called Bottled and Sold on Bottled Water. And one of his arguments is, you know, increasing the capacity to access water through fountains that have disappeared. I said to him that I thought that's a really powerful food justice issue. And that there needs to be that kind of linkage. And he sees that as well. And so that would be another example. You don't want Aquafina necessarily for a kid in a low-income school to pop a dollar in because the sodas aren't there, so he'll get the bottled water and the profits will still flow to Pepsi. You want the drinking water fountain that's there, right there, that have been taken out of all the schools. So another food justice struggle that we need to make.
Yes, I was wanting to know about Jamie Oliver and his influence when he came over from England, which I thought was really a fun program to watch. And then also Alice Water, when she was working with Michelle Obama, you know, to set up the gardens at Washington, D.C., at the White House. Those two issues. I was wondering, they kind of petered out, it seems like.
Well, you know, let me say a couple of things on both those counts. A lot of times we don't recognize the food justice champion's role in making change happen. So the issue around Jamie Oliver, he's this English chef who came in, did a reality TV program, went to West Virginia, and said, you know, the food in the community here, the largest obesity rates in the country, and the food really sucks, and why don't you do this and that? to change the food environment. And he really took off after the school food service people, which I think was the wrong target. You know, he got a lot of feedback from that, so he's trying to rethink a little bit of how he's going to do his reality TV. But he's come to L.A., so we're talking to him all the time now, and he wants to set up a – because one of the arguments we said is, why don't you profile farm-to-school programs or other things that are going on? Go to New Orleans. Talk to the rethinkers. You don't have to necessarily come in and say it's all it's really awful when people are really – beginning to change it, or profile somebody like Rodney Taylor. That was our argument. And now we're in dialogue with him in L.A. about he wants to set up more permanently in L.A. So we're hoping that he begins to meet the people on the ground who are really bringing about the changes and sees himself as part of that process. On the garden, on the Michelle Obama garden, there was a wonderful initiative that was started by a group in Maine, part of an organization that is one of the big urban agriculture advocates, the group called Kitchen Gardeners International. And they started a campaign in probably it was the spring of 08 to have a garden in the White House. And they did all kinds of creative organizing things. They got word in, out through people who wrote about it in the press. Alice Waters had actually tried to start a garden with Clinton and didn't get anywhere. And there really wasn't the kind of mobilizing and organizing that when you bring about change, that's part of the process of how change happens. It wouldn't have happened without Michelle Obama actually starting the garden, of course, and the symbolism that went into it that was really important. But it also came about, there was this process, there were people on the ground who came up with the idea as a way to symbolize the idea that you could do a garden anywhere was to do it on the White House lawn. And then she had her chef who was into local food and gardens, and she herself was. And so it finally got, it percolated in, and she moved on it. Did the Maine folks make Michelle Obama move to set up a school garden? Probably not directly, but certainly indirectly it became part of a process that did lead to that change. And that's what I also mean by kind of a long march through the institutions, in this case the institution of the White House, if you will, in one very particular example of that. You know, Alice Waters is, you know, a food champion, for sure, created visibility around a lot of things in terms of food. She's done things like on this bottled water issue. She's picked up on it also. But it's important to think of people in the context of a larger movement, and change comes about when social movements mobilize. And maybe, I don't know, we're getting close to the end. Let me end with a story from the book, and those of you who read the book will remember the story. And this is came through... one of the folks who heard it from Michael Pollan, didn't get it from Michael directly, but Michael Pollan tells a story about when he wrote this piece in the New York Times magazine about, if you might have remembered, during the fall of 08, in the midst of the election, he did this wonderful piece about kind of the solar-based food system versus the oil-based food system, and linked it to all kinds of ways to think about food systems issues. And Obama read the article. It came up in a course of a conversation he had with Joe Klein. And, you know, yeah, I get it, but what do you do with it? So he then subsequently had this meeting with Pollan, and he turned and he said, look, I get it, but are you a movement? Can you, in effect, get people to mobilize to make me change? And Poland didn't have an answer. And that's really the situation we confront today. Are we a movement? Has food justice emerged so that, in fact, we can bring about that change? And the answer is not fully clear, but we can see that there are points of entree to building that social movement, that food justice movement, that social justice movement, and we can tell Obama, you got to listen to us. You got to make the change. So I'll stop with that.
You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker has been Robert Gottlieb, author of the new book, Food Justice. And now this program of the Commonwealth Club, where you are in the know, is adjourned.